everyone. This is Cartoons to Castles,
the history behind the mouse and magic. I'm Melanie.
And I'm Jessica. We're best friends and Disney nerds who wanted to learn more about the history behind the Walt Disney Company's movies, shows, music, theme parks, and more, and share it all with you.
So thanks for listening, and we hope you enjoy today's episode.
Welcome back, everyone, to episode 7.
Episode 7, yay!
Well, we are super excited for this week's episode, but before we go into what it's about, we have a new review that we're going to read. And also wanted to say really quickly, if you leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, we'll be sure to read it here on our full episodes. And also, thank you guys for doing that. Not only is it really great to read those positive reviews, but it helps us so much in people discovering our work, since the more ratings we get, the higher the ranking in Apple Podcasts.
Yeah.
It's like a spider.
Everything's a mess today. Sorry.
All right. Okay. Well, while Jess deals with a spider, I will read the review. This is from Ashley Michelle XO. She says, "Disney history lovers unite! 5 stars. This podcast makes me so happy, and as someone who loves all things Disney, I am enjoying learning so many new things. The research that goes into this podcast does not go unnoticed. I also laugh out loud every episode and just have a good time. Look forward to more episodes."
That is our goal, to be funny, but also well-researched. So thank
right.
you.
Right, yeah. We love it when we can get the laughs. That's really nice.
Yeah, so this week, we'll be doing our first episode where we talk about a specific person who is a huge part of Disney history. We will be discussing the artwork and contributions of Disney legend Mary Blair, who created concept art, which influenced the stylings for Cinderella, Alice in Wonderland, Peter Pan, as well as did work on so many other Disney films. She also served as art supervisor on The Three Caballeros and Saludos Amigos, as well as helped design the classic attraction It's a Small World.
And we are thrilled to have a present-day Disney artist joining us this week to discuss this topic. Her work has been featured in Wonderground Gallery at both Disneyland and Walt Disney World Resorts, and she is also an artist featured annually at Festival of the Arts in Epcot. She frequently creates Disney doodles for Disney Parks blog and has many designs featured on apparel for Her Universe, Hot Topic, Box Lunch, and more.
Please welcome Ashley Taylor.
Hi, yay. Everyone.
Hi.
Oh my gosh, I'm so excited.
Oh my gosh. I am so excited to talk about Mary Blair with you. I know how passionate you are about her.
And we love Mary Blair. We love her
yes.
work. Yeah.
And also, so Ashley, you have been a part of this podcast, even though you haven't been on air yet. You've been a part of it since before it started, because Ashley Taylor designed our lovely Cartoons to Castles logo.
Yes!
Yes, I love our logo so much. Would you mind telling our listeners what the inspiration is, or kind of the little hidden pieces inside the logo?
Yeah, you know, well, first of all, the two of you sent me like the most beautiful dream board that I think I've ever seen.
Which
in my
included
entire
your work.
Career.
And it included some of your work.
I know. I was so touched by that. And it was just so dreamy. And I was like, whatever these girls are creating, it's going to be huge, because like aww. This dream board alone is amazing and so aww. Beautiful. And yeah, so I really took a lot of your like color aesthetic, and I know you both love like the 50s and 60s traditional illustration styles, so mm-hmm. I kind of incorporated that as well. And I also thought, well, you know, they're talking about cartoons, so maybe I'll incorporate like one of those classic animator tables. So I included that in the logo as well. So it kind of encompasses everything you're about to talk about on your podcast.
Yeah.
Like, if you don't know what an animator's table looks like, it doesn't matter. Like, the logo still is beautiful. But if you do know what an animator's table looks like, it's just that little cherry on top of the cake that you're like, that's an animator's table.
Oh,
like, it's really fun.
Yeah. And for those who are maybe wondering, to jog your memory, you've probably seen an animator's table if you're a Disney fan or have been to the Disney parks. But it's just, you know, that wooden desk, but it's the white circle that has a light oftentimes behind it. And then a line on top, a line at the bottom with pegs on it to put your paper. And that's what the logo is. And so I'll point out those details, too, on our Instagram.
And of course, the beautiful castle, which is inspired by the Disney castles, but is also your own creation, which I thought was really beautiful and clever and just perfect.
Oh, thank you. You know, I just researched a lot of different like castles around the world that I love, and I tried to really look at different elements of castles that I really think are aesthetically pleasing, and I thought it'd be fun to put together a classic castle just for you two.
Yeah. It's beautiful.
It was amazing. Ashley sent us so many amazing options. It was a very hard choice to choose because we loved them all, but we just loved that special secret touch of the animator's table being obviously Disney history geeks as we are. And I also love the pixie dust in the turquoise space behind the castle. I love that because it looks so, it just has that mid-century modern kind of Mary Blair-ish look to me. So I
exactly.
Yeah.
And Jess and I, both of our husbands are graphic designers and started in graphic design, and Garrett does illustration in it. So we know like how much work goes into all the little tiny details to try to create the perfect logo that encompasses whatever the idea is or whatever the product is. And we're just so appreciative of the work you did.
Oh, thank you. Well, you guys, like, especially with the mood board, like stuff like that helps us as artists so much because it's kind of just like a window into, you know, your world and what you want to convey and what you want to say. So it was so much fun to work on it. Truthfully, it was just such a fun little dream project to work on. Yay. It's almost like creating your own kingdom, like within that whole universe.
Yeah, exactly.
And we'll have to dig up those mood boards and share those on our Instagram stories as well. And also, you know, Ashley, just you and I being friends, it felt really special. I liked that this is a project that I'm working on with not just Melanie, but you also are a part of it too. So that was really special.
Yeah, definitely. It's always fun to be able to work on projects with your friends because you just know them so well and you know their taste and what they look for. And I especially know like things that you love and things that you gravitate towards. So it made the job very easy for me.
Yeah. Well, your aesthetic fit the bill 100%, which is why we wanted you to do the logo.
Aww, it just
was like, this is the aesthetic that we want for the vibe and all that.
Yes. You know, we're just fans of your art. Like, I love all of your Disney doodles
and
the things you designed for, you know, Her Universe and Box Lunch. Like, I want every piece. I can't afford to get every piece, but I want every piece.
That means so much. Yeah. And, you know, any opportunity, you know, we've been friends for so long. So any opportunity to help like make your dream a realization is something that, of course, I'm always going to be on board with.
Thanks guys for listening to our gush session over here. If you follow me on Instagram, you know, I always get very sentimental, so I can go on and on about things like this. But before we dove into the Mary Blair topic, even before we started our podcast, I was like, Ashley, you have to come on sometime and talk about the logo. So we did.
Yay.
All right. So should we dive into Mary Blair?
Yes, let's do it. We have some interesting stories.
All right. And I always feel like I come with so many notes. So I'm going to try to be concise, but it may run long. So I'm hoping.
Me too.
I mean, especially with this topic, there was so much interesting stuff. I mean, just buckle up, guys. It'll be a fun adventure.
Mary Blair. A lot of her art in front of me too.
Oh, yay.
It helps me to talk about her when I'm actually like looking at the imagery.
Yes.
So what I want to say first is that there needs to be a definitive Mary Blair biography, like a thick biography, like, because there are art books that give biographical information, which is awesome. But I want a Mary Blair biography. Yeah. So I'm hoping that at some point that will be written by someone who's better at researching and writing than I am. So let's all hope for a Mary Blair biography.
We're the researching and talking department. researching.
You know, I would love to see a movie of her life.
That would be
amazing. You know, periodically it goes from a live action to an animation. So it showcases the thoughts in her mind and going back to it. I think that would be such a great idea for a film.
Disney, are you listening? Could be like Saving Mr. Banks style, only, you know, with the animation and
Mm-hmm. I love that idea.
Let's make it happen somehow.
Somehow.
Okay. So anyway, lack of comprehensive Mary Blair biography notwithstanding, we'll go into her early life. So she was born Mary Brown Robinson on October 21st, 1911 in Oklahoma. She moved to Texas while she was still a small child and then later to Morgan Hill, California in the early 1920s. So after graduating from San Jose State University, which she attended from 1929 to 1931, she won a scholarship to the Chouinard Art Institute. I looked up how to pronounce it, but it was still challenging. Chouinard Art Institute in Los Angeles, which was later absorbed into Cal Arts. Some interesting trivia, which has trained many Disney artists and animators. She graduated in 1933, and in 1934, she married another artist, Lee Everett Blair. And with her husband, she was a member of the important California Regionalist School of Watercolor of the 1930s, and quickly became known for being an imaginative colorist and designer. And artists who worked with her will continue to talk about her relationship to color and how inspiring and different it was. So that will come up a lot, actually, that she was very creative with her use of color. And I just thought this was a beautiful quote. When talking about her husband, Mary said, "We are artists, dear, in love with art and each other. We must make these loves coincide and melt into a beautiful, happy, and rich life. That is our future. We'll live to be happy and paint to express our happiness." So I just thought that was a beautiful...
Imagine that in a movie.
I know. Wouldn't that be beautiful? Like, they were such a pair of talented artists who both worked for Disney. That would just be so amazing to see that on the screen. But anyway, we're daydreaming. So... So to give a little context, I wanted to talk about just briefly early women working at Disney. So the first woman to receive named credit on a Disney film was Retta Scott, who worked as an animator on 1942's Bambi. And nearly a decade earlier, in 1934, Bianca Majoli, I think is how you pronounce it, was hired by her high school acquaintance, Walt Disney. You know how she just went to high school with Walt Disney to work in the previously all-male story department. And before then, women were mostly ink and paint departments where they would trace and color outlines made by male animators. And there was a rejection letter making the rounds a few years ago that a female artist had received from the Walt Disney Studios. And it said, "Women do not do any of the creative work in connection with preparing the cartoons for the screen." And that was kind of the standard at the time. Like any animation studio you would go to, the women would not be doing any of the main work. And, luckily, that did change over the years, largely because of Bianca Majoli. Her persistence paved the way for artists like Mary Blair. And during Disney early days, they worked on many of the movies we now consider classics, like Snow White, Dumbo, Fantasia, Pinocchio, Bambi, Peter Pan, Alice in Wonderland, and Cinderella, to name a few. And a lot of the time, they put their own personal struggles and achievements into the movies, or they were influenced by their lives. So that kind of gives context to the world that Mary Blair was coming into. So at the height of the Depression, Mary took a job in the animation unit of Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, rather than pursue her dream of a fine arts career, in order to stay financially afloat, since being a fine artist during the Depression would have been very difficult to make a living. And she would soon leave and join her husband Lee at the UB Iwerks studio. And if people don't know, UB Iwerks was an influential artist with Disney, but for a time they had a falling out and split, parted ways, and then they started to work together again. So during that time that they had parted ways, Mary Blair worked at UB Iwerks Studio, and then they ended up moving on to Disney. She was first hired by the Walt Disney Company in 1940 to develop concept art and designs, but decided she'd rather be an illustrator, and then left in the summer of 1941. So she was pulled back into the company when her husband, who also worked for Disney, was asked to join Disney's Goodwill tour to South America to gather research for potential film projects. And she asked to be rehired in order to join the trip. And Walt was like, yeah, because he loved Mary Blair. He loved her work. He was so inspired by her. So he was like, yes, please come along. So this is just kind of an overview of her sort of influence on the Disney company. So during her time at Disney, she developed a distinct look to her concept art by using vivid colors from gouache and tempera to create imaginative images that influenced many of Disney's feature films of the 1940s and 50s. Her unique designs led Walt Disney to assign her work on the films The Adventures of Ichabod and Mr. Toad from 1949, Cinderella 1950, Alice in Wonderland in 1951, and Peter Pan in 1953, among others. And she has long been considered to be one of Walt's favorite artists, and he even had a few of her paintings displayed in his own home. So that kind of shows how much he personally loved her art.
I wonder where they are today. I wonder if they're still
part of the family.
Yeah, I would like probably. To know. Maybe they're in the family
That's
museum.
That's a great question. Maybe I'll shoot them over an email. Ask.
Yeah.
You should.
Yeah, that would be cool if we could find that out. So Mary was, in many ways, kind of different than the other artists at the Walt Disney Studios. Her style completely contrasted the looks of the films that preceded her involvement. And her work was not only eye-catching, but as museum curator and historian John Canemaker notes, whether they be mundane seasonal changes or high drama, Blair comes through with inspiring and inspired suggestions for staging, color, and performance. So I liked him talking about staging because a lot of her concept art, you can see, oh, the actual concept art and how the artist recreated it in the movie into a moving scene. The staging is so similar.
Yeah.
You see a shot of, you know, you're going to talk about Cinderella, Ashley, but the Cinderella coach riding up to the castle, and you can see that influence in movies like that. So I thought that was a very fitting quote.
Yeah, exactly.
And Disney Imagineering artist Roland Crump also praised Mary, telling John Canemaker that the way she painted, in a lot of ways, she was still a little girl. Walt was like that. You could see he could relate to children. She was the same way. And I really liked that, too, because she did have a very creative and childlike sense of color in the best possible way, just very unconventional and creative. You could really see, especially in some of her later designs for Small World, how childlike it was and how innocent and beautiful. And I know you're going to talk about that, Jess. So moving on to Fantasia in 1940, she initially worked on a segment for the film called The Baby Ballet, which was to be set to Chopin's Berceuse Lullaby. And the sequence would have parodied sort of the grand musical revues and featured babies performing dance steps in a nursery while they were being fed, diapered, and bathed by a flock of storks. This would have been a super cute overload sequence, of course. Unfortunately, it was eliminated in the development stage, but you can still see Mary's very adorable concept art online. If you like babies, you'll love this artwork because it is super cute. Hey, you like babies? You'll like this art. So moving on to the Goodwill Tour of 1941, there is so much information on this Goodwill Tour that we will probably do another episode
it's
on it
been
in the future.
Spanning. Yeah, we talked a bit about it last week with our Three Caballeros episode, but obviously not about the Mary Blair portion. So we're getting little snippets as time goes on because there's just too much.
It's very dense. So I'll just talk a little bit about Mary Blair's specific influence during this Goodwill Tour. As we talked about in the last episode, Walt was asked by the U.S. government to go on a Goodwill tour of South America in 1941, and he agreed to travel there with the purpose of doing research for films with Latin American themes. And this group who went on that trip became known as El Grupo. So for short, when I talk about that group, I'm going to call them El Grupo. As the artists from Burbank journeyed through South America in 1941, Mary was amazed by the vibrant colors she glimpsed. The watercolor paintings she made during this trip depict a variety of those colors. These works of art are early examples of how the Latin American trip inspired Mary to cultivate an artistic style all her own. And no one was really prepared for the creative explosion that would take place in Mary's art in South America. And it was a pivotal event in her career that really influenced her creativity from that point on. Upon their return, Blair created concept art that ended up being used for films inspired by the trip, including Saludos Amigos and The Three Caballeros. And Walt appointed her as an art supervisor for the films as well. So let's talk about Saludos Amigos, which was released in 1942. El Grupo visited Bolivia and Peru in 1941 and were inspired by the scenic vistas of Lake Titicaca, as well as the llamas that populated the region. Mary's sketches and paintings, as well as Jack Miller's, served as inspiration for that segment of the film in which Donald Duck is a hapless tourist in the region and has some unfortunate run-ins with an obstinate llama. I think obstinate llama should be the title for something. I don't know what, but it's fun. It was the first time a Disney cartoon character was featured in a geographic region outside of the usual home turf. The other segment heavily inspired by Mary's work and of her husband Lee was Aquarela do Brasil, which is Portuguese for watercolor of Brazil. The sequence starts out with watercolors of Brazilian flora and fauna coming to life, and the finale features the first appearance of the Brazilian parrot character José Carioca, who later became one of the Three Caballeros. Mary and Lee's expertise in watercolor was helpful in developing the beautiful look of this segment. And you can really see the influence when you watch this. It's just, it literally starts with a paintbrush doing watercolor across the screen and it kind of bleeding down into the next picture and then coming to life and adding different brush strokes. So it really feels like an artist-led segment. Not that others aren't, but it really felt very artistic.
Yes. You know? Yeah.
So it was hard to find stories about her concept art for Dumbo and Bambi. You could see her concept art, but there weren't really anecdotes behind it. But she did create concept art for both Dumbo in 1941 and Bambi in 1942. Her ideas heavily influenced the baby mind sequence in Dumbo, which many people cannot watch because it's devastatingly sad.
Oh my gosh,
I can barely talk about it because it makes me tear up immediately. So we will move on to the Three Caballeros. So this film was released in 1944, as we talked about in our last segment or our last episode. The Bahia segment, which takes us on a journey into Brazil, was heavily influenced by Mary's art. She designed Aurora Miranda's costume for the segment, which I did not know, as well as the colorful little train that transports the audience from Rio to Bahia.
Which, that's the best part. It's my favorite scene.
So cute. The train was painted in bright pinks, oranges, and yellows, and it kind of achieved sort of a little bit of notoriety within the studio. People seemed to really like that little train, and the concept was transferred to the screen intact. So it was one of the things that Mary designed that she felt was the most her vision. And she later wrote, "Only on the little train sequence did I feel that it was really my own artwork and my style." But she also painted the backgrounds for the scene with bright jungle plants on a black background. And despite her feeling like the train sequence was the closest to her actual work in style and execution, Mary's influence was truly everywhere on the film, as her eye for visual style and her knowledge that she kept continuing to gain and grow of Latin American cultures made her indispensable for both the live action and animated sequences of the movie. Mary and the other members of El Grupo witnessed a Las Posadas Christmas Eve ritual in Mexico City in 1942 and were inspired by its beauty. If people are unfamiliar with Las Posadas, during the ceremony, children replicate the journey of Mary and Joseph walking door to door looking for shelter on the eve of the birth of Jesus. And Mary's paintings of Las Posadas are brought to life in the film with minimal animation enhanced by twinkling stars and flickering candles. So they actually used her paintings in the film, and they're kind of still, and the camera kind of moves across them. And then there's just little tiny effects enhancements here and there. But I actually didn't know that. I thought that was really cool that it's her actual paintings that you can see in the movie.
I love that.
Yeah. And she also worked on some shorts, which I remember watching as a kid, and I really liked them. Her concept art inspired the look of some short cartoons from 1952. Susie the Little Blue Coupe is about an anthropomorphic car that gets wrecked and then refurbished, and the vehicles in the 2006 Disney Pixar movie Cars were also heavily modeled on Susie's design, with sort of the windshield serving as the eyes of the car.
Wow. Mm-hmm. I feel like I vaguely remember that short from my childhood.
Oh, it's so cute.
I feel like once you said that, I was like, whoa, a memory unlocked of watching that as a child.
Yeah, if you go back and look at Susie, you can really see the similarities between Cars and Susie's design.
That's one of the first things I thought of when I first saw Cars. I was like, it reminds me of something, and I can't remember what.
And that's just so cool to think that she's still influencing movies.
Oh, yeah.
That's amazing. Yeah.
And so the other one from 1952 was The Little House, and it was based on a popular children's book. It was actually one of my favorite books growing up when I was a kid. And a bit of trivia, the apartments and skyscrapers from this cartoon make a cameo appearance in Toontown in the 1988 Disney movie Who Framed Roger Rabbit?
Wow. Yeah. So cool.
Yeah. So the next one I'm going to talk about is 1948's Melody Time. This is one of the package films, and the package films are basically a film put together of a lot of short films. And there were several of those that were made during this time period, and this was one of them. And this was the cartoon that was on a lot of, or I don't know how many Christmas specials, but at least one Christmas special that I would watch as a kid that featured Disney Christmas cartoons. So looking at Once like an old-fashioned greeting card and a cutting-edge experiment in modern design, Once Upon a Wintertime. Yes, Once Upon a Wintertime.
That's like my favorite Disney short ever.
It's so beautiful. Cute.
You've done a Disney doodle of that, haven't you?
I've done a couple Disney doodles, and I was so excited that other people loved it as much as I do.
Yeah, because
I listen to the music from that short whenever I'm having a bad day. Like that's like my favorite.
I gotta try that. That sounds so beautiful.
Yeah.
And it's a Victorian era tale of cute couple Jenny and Joe, and great costume designs also, by the way, who find unexpected adventure on a sleigh ride ice skating expedition. So set to the title tune, sung by recording star Frances Langford, this nostalgic segment was produced as an effort to bring Mary's distinctive graphic stylings to the screen. Disney legend Ken O'Connor championed Blair's designs. He was a veteran layout artist, and he arranged to have the animators draw in a decorative, designy way, quote, reflecting Mary's conceptual art, while also enlisting Disney background artist Art Riley to paint the story settings in Blair's non-rounded contemporary style. And if you compare her concept art to the cartoon, it is really, really close. Like, they really did a good job of replicating and animating her concept art. It really looks a lot alike. And she also provided inspiration in this movie for the Johnny Appleseed segment, creating folk art style concepts that emphasize the more playful and colorful elements of the character's life. So I'm going to jump ahead a little to Lady and the Tramp, which was released in 1955. And like many Disney animated features of the 1950s, Lady and the Tramp had its origins in the days before World War II, and Walt himself had been instrumental in the story's genesis. Its development spanned more than a decade from concept to completion, and a fair number of artists took their turn on the film's design. Among the earliest were Joe Grant, who also contributed to the story, and originally the background artist was supposed to be Mary Blair, and she did some inspirational sketches and art for the film. But she left the studio to become a children's book illustrator in 1953. She started work on it very early, even though it wasn't released till 1955. So we are going to jump from her work on to Ashley, who's going to cover the next round of films that Mary Blair created art for.
Yay! Well, what I love about these three films is that they all showcase different tricks and skills that she's learned along the way. So starting with Cinderella, it's just so lush and romantic and dreamy, and she really plays with the environments, and she creates all these like abstract shapes within the scenes just by shrubbery and building designs, and she can really make a scene that would normally be very simple incredibly emotional. And one example of that is there's a painting she did where Cinderella's just in her little room in her tower, and everything's pretty dark in the background, but the window is so bright and there's so much light coming out of it. And in that moment, you just realize the hope and the happiness and her reason for waking up in the morning, and nothing else matters but that one reason, what's on the other side of that window. Mm-hmm. You'll notice it's a pattern throughout a lot of her paintings. You'll see it also in when she's prepping the meals for Anastasia, Drizella, and Lady Tremaine. There's a painting that's very similar, and it has that window that's just this bright light. And I just love that. I love that always a little bit of hope in her pieces.
Yeah.
And another piece that I really love, and I think I probably share this on my Instagram more than anything, but it's Cinderella in her peasant dress, and she's standing in front of this gorgeous gilded mirror, and the background has this like very lavish and detailed wallpaper, and you know, everything is so grand surrounding her, and she's in this very simple peasant dress, and she's just staring at her reflection, and she just puts a little flower in her hair, and it's such a simple image, but when you look at it, you can see the contrast of her having nothing in this lavish environment. And she's looking at herself, but she's still doing something to make her life a little bit happier, to lift her spirits and make herself a little bit have that hope in her life and something to keep dreaming for.
Oh my gosh, I got goosebumps. I love that. I love that.
That feels very you, Ashley, like that kind of
I was thinking the like that, same thing.
That hopefulness and, you know, beautifying the world.
Oh, thank you. That kind of just
makes me think of
you. Well, especially in your Cinderella painting that you did for, was it for last year's Festival of the Arts?
It was for 2019. So yeah, last January.
Yes, 2019 Festival of the Arts, at which I'm sure if people are familiar with your work, they've seen it, of Cinderella walking up the stairs and she sees there's a shadow that kind of reflects.
Yeah, she
well,
stands
you can
and
talk about it better than I.
And it's funny because I really tried to give Mary Blair a little bit of a voice through my art, because I always try to give a throwback to the artists that came before me. Mm-hmm. So that's why you see the really bright window in my art piece. And then it casts a shadow on the wall, and the shadow is Cinderella dancing with her prince. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the title of the piece is They Can't Order Me to Stop Dreaming, just to show similar to the vibe that she wanted to portray in her painting, where, you know, no matter what circumstance you're coming from, you can always dream for something bigger. Mm-hmm. Like, no one can stop you. Your dreams don't have expiration dates.
Yeah. I love that you really, it's very much your style, but I definitely see the Mary Blair influence, and I love how you just found that perfect balance of
and it's funny, the original. In that piece in particular, in the right corner of that piece, I actually have little pink roses on the table, because that's my nod to loving that painting of Cinderella looking at her reflection in the mirror that I've always loved from Mary Blair. So I was like, oh my gosh, the pink flower she puts in her hair. I have to have pink flowers somewhere in my piece just to
that's so sweet.
Give a nod to that moment.
I love that so much.
Going back to more amazing Cinderella art, and actually going back to what you were talking about with the staging and like the choreography that she would kind of set in her artwork, I love every scene where she paints the carriage like flying down the street, because you'll notice that all of the trees and shrubbery and flowers, they all bend in the same direction to really give that scene that movement and that sense of urgency. So I love that she would influence the animation in a lot of scenes because of her vision and the emotions that she wanted to convey.
And you know what? I'm sorry to jump in, Ashley. I actually forgot to talk about the adventures of Ichabod and Mr. Toad. But
oh, go ahead.
But I just wanted to add to that. I don't really have anything significant to contribute as far as that. But there is a similarity between those concept art pieces, weirdly, and Cinderella, because there's so much motion in the Adventures of Ichabod concept art, because it's all movement. It's a headless horseman racing through the woods, and all of the foliage seems to go with him. And when he's throwing the flaming skull, which I think was later turned into a flaming jack-o'-lantern to be like scary. There's just so much motion. And that's what I loved about her Cinderella concept art as well, is all of the motion and movement of just a still painting. You just feel the movement.
Yeah, there's another beautiful painting of Cinderella and Prince Charming just sort of like waltzing into the clouds with like all like the magic and the pixie dust kind of surrounding them. And like, it, again, you can feel it. Like, you can hear "So This Is Love" when you look at that painting.
Yeah.
She creates so much movement and motion with her artwork. It's just unbelievable. Mm-hmm. And another piece that I really love, and it goes back to, I think she always like finds a way to put a little bit of hope in her pieces. And there was a painting she did of Cinderella's castle. Is a tapestry painting that she did, and like the edges of it are kind of like tattered and sharp edges, but when you get towards the center, everything becomes a little more clear and the castle becomes more and more beautiful the more you look in the middle of the painting. And that always, I've always interpreted it as, you know, when you have a dream and you're continuously fighting towards it, it starts to become a reality for you. Yeah. So it starts off small and then it starts to become more and more clear. And I've just like, that's what I've always seen in her artwork. I've always seen the hope and the little bit of inspiration that she's put in her pieces. And I think that's why people gravitate towards it so much.
Oh, yeah. Definitely.
Yeah. And I feel like, you know, so many artists who worked alongside her described her work as childlike. And obviously that doesn't mean, you know, it looked like a child did it. But in just, I think in terms of she wasn't afraid to let her imagination run free. She didn't feel it. You could tell that she didn't put boundaries up to her imagination and to letting emotions be conveyed.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people relate to her being childlike because of the geometric shapes that she used. But for me, it's just so brilliant to be able to look at literally anything and be able to break it down in a way that everyone can understand it.
Oh, yeah, that's a really good way of putting it. When they say childlike, it's so imaginative that it can translate to anyone. It can translate to a child. It can translate to it and to an adult. Anyone can look at it and feel the piece.
Exactly. You can have absolutely zero context behind the artwork and you're still going to feel something when you look at it. Mm-hmm. And that's why she's so popular all around the world. Like I've been to galleries in Tokyo where they have Mary Blair art and they just love her work. And she's just one of those rare gems that just finds that way to connect in so many ways through lighting and emotion and color. And it's just such a beautiful thing. And I think that's why so many artists want to become professional artists, because they want to be able to be that person that brings joy into other people's lives.
Yeah. Yeah.
So should we move to Alice?
Yes.
Oh, yes.
Your fave, or one of your favorites.
I love the color palette of this movie. Yes.
Oh, I love this color palette.
Oh, I love
Let's
it.
Get ready.
Let's get into it.
I feel like what I love the most about Alice is she really pushed so many boundaries, not just with like color, but with shapes and patterns. Mm-hmm. And there are so many iconic pieces of artwork where it's just like these layers of patterns on top of each other and all different colors, and they all just work and blend seamlessly together. Mm-hmm. And it's very dynamic and it's very exciting. And at the same time, it's curious. And that's what Alice is. You're more and more interested the more you look around and you're like, what is even happening here? But that's what Alice in Wonderland is.
Yes.
It's giving that whole world for her to completely play in. I've heard from other artists and I've read before that she had a little bit of a different vision with Ward Kimball about making it a little darker. Have you heard that?
No, I hadn't.
Almost like what the Tulgi Wood scene is, but making it almost the entire film a little bit darker and a little bit more moody and a little bit more mysterious.
Oh,
and
interesting.
I even read that for the tea party scene, they were originally planning on having the tea party and the characters very colorful and dynamic, and then the background more of a black and white grayscale, so that the focus would solely be on them, which also I think would have really worked for that film.
Yeah,
and it's just interesting seeing her, because you can see like there are some darker paintings that she did, especially if you see the Queen of Hearts castle painting that she did. Mm-hmm. Like that one's very moody and mysterious. And
I've never seen it. I'll have to look it up.
Oh my gosh. It's like the pinks, but then there's also that black and white grayscale type of background where it's ominous but uplifting at the same time, because that's kind of the feeling that Alice gets when she walks in there, because it's this gorgeous castle, but also this like incoming feeling of maybe I shouldn't be here.
Right.
Yeah.
And the color against the black and white is sort of like a playing card. Yeah, that would have been really interesting.
Yeah. And again, with the choreography, when you look at all of her paintings of the cards that are marching along, like you can feel the movement, and it's almost one of those paintings that you feel like you can stare at for a while and then all of a sudden they're all gonna start moving on
you.
Yeah, they'll come to life.
Yeah, you could definitely see the direction that she was going in. And every time I look at her artwork, it just puts this big smile on my face, because it's almost like a kaleidoscope, and every time you look at it, it's something different that you notice about it.
I love that.
Do you guys have a certain scene that you love in Alice in Wonderland? Or favorite painting of hers?
Well, I think the Cinderella concept art is my favorite. I mean, Cinderella is one of my favorite Disney movies. It was my favorite Disney movie up until Princess and the Frog came out. But even then, they're still pretty neck and neck. You know, I just feel, obviously, she had a lot of influence in it. And I feel like the feeling of hopefulness during a dark time. I just feel like that's so quintessentially Disney, which makes sense mm-hmm. that, you know, Disney and her had such an amazing, you know, working relationship. It makes sense. Like, I feel like they both were on the same train of thought in how they, this kind of stories that they wanted to tell.
They were both like motivated by their dreams. And it was almost like as their dreams were coming true, they were finding ways to let everyone else in the world know that their dreams can come true as well. And I think that's what we all kind of like hold on to.
Yeah, I really love the tea party scene and her art, and even the teacup ride at Disneyland. Just the colors of it make me so happy.
It does look like a Mary Blair painting.
I know, it really does.
I must have a million pictures of the teacups with the lanterns lit at night because I just love those colors so much. And Ashley, you actually, didn't you design some skirts in the teacup pattern?
Yes. Oh my gosh. Well, that was Ashley Eckstein's, one of her dream things with Disney. And I remember she was discussing it with Dress Shop for such a long time. And then finally she contacted me and she's like, we can finally do it. We have permission to do it. And I was so excited. And I hope we can like come out with like new patterns and colors in the future. Cause I just loved watching people just walking around the parks wearing their little teacup skirts because it looked like they were just like always on the ride.
Yes,
like
always. It's so cute.
You can't have a bad day in that skirt. It was just so fun. And I was tagged in so many people's birthday parties. Like that became a birthday skirt for people to wear.
Yeah.
And for me, that was like the ultimate dream and compliment that, you know, you're celebrating this amazing milestone and special day and you chose to wear something that I helped create. Like that was so amazing for me.
Well, I was going to say, I associate that skirt with you. Of course, you designed it. But if I'm just picturing Ashley in my head, I picture you in that outfit. I think also partly because the first time I met you, you were wearing that skirt.
I think so. You were.
I think about the dress that Ashley designed. It's this like Fantasyland or Sleeping Beauty Castle, like off the shoulder dress. Because I went to a signing with you and Ashley Eckstein and you were wearing that gorgeous dress. And I was like, that is so pretty. And you designed it. Like you were wearing your own dress that you designed. I was like, that's so cool.
Such a crazy moment. And I still to this day, whenever I see people wearing any type of clothing that I've ever designed, I have this internal wrestle in my head. I'm like, oh, I want to go tell them that I did that. And I'm like, no, that's so creepy. Why would you do that?
I think that's cool, you know. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. Would like, but we're Disney nerds. Yeah. I would enjoy that.
I did once in Wonderground. I overheard a girl say, "Like, I love Ashley Taylor," and she was like, had like my work in her hands, and I was like, okay, even if I look like a loser walking over to her, like I'm still going to just be like, hey, I'm here. And if you want me to sign it, I can do that.
I mean, that would be so amazing. Cool. I'm sure she loved it.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. She was so excited. And I was like, you know what? I'd rather look like a fool than, you know, have her have that missed opportunity if she wanted them signed.
That's really nice.
I feel, you know, you do have the similar themes of dreams come true and hope, you know, those quintessential Disney themes, what Mary Blair incorporated to her work, that exudes in your own work as well. Both Garrett and I have a piece by you in our offices. Well, they're sitting here ready to be hung. We just need to get frames because you know, we just moved. But I mean, it's both like the center art piece. It is going to be the center art piece in our office. Garrett has the one that Ladies of the Force, Women of the Force.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, that one that you did of all the Star Wars ladies as constellations. And then I have your Tiana piece that you did for this year's 2020 Festival of the Arts because I love Tiana. And that piece also definitely, you know, has the dreams come true. Do you want to
say
what that is?
So
that for those who haven't seen it, no.
Yeah. And it's funny. Maybe I just have like mirrors and reflections and things like in my mind all the time. But the painting is of Tiana and Lottie, and they're both kind of sitting in front of her mirror. And Tiana has her like picture of Tiana's place that she's showing Lottie. Like, you know, when you have a friend that is wonderful in your life, you want to share your dreams and hopes with them. So Tiana's sharing that while Lottie is just like joyously listening to her. And then in the reflection in the mirror is both of them as kids. to show just like how long their friendship is and how amazing their bond is, because like we all need Tianas and Lotties in our lives that are just going to lift us up. And that was such a fun piece for me to create. And I think my favorite part about that piece is so many people bought them in pairs because they wanted me to fill it out for their best friend or for their sister or family member.
Cute.
Everyone could look at it and they saw some important bond in their life that they related to. And that was like the biggest compliment
including
as an artist.
Including Tiana and Lottie themselves, the voice actresses.
Oh my gosh. When they told me about it, I was freaking out.
Wait, I don't know about this. Tell me what happened.
They tweeted me about it.
Anika Noni Rose and...
And Jennifer Cody.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, and I was just like, oh my gosh. I was freaking out about it because getting their approval like just means the world when, you know, it's the person that inspires these characters and voices these characters. They're both amazing legends. Yeah, that was such a great feeling because especially a lot of the pieces I've done are, you know, older pieces like Cinderella's from like the 50s and Peter Pan's a lot older. So to do like a newer film and be recognized like in present day with the actresses that are still here with us today is so amazing.
Mm-hmm. That's so awesome. Anyway, sorry, I know that sidetrack from Mary Blair, but
we went off gushing about Ashley again.
I mean, yeah, we just gush.
Oh my gosh, you guys are the sweetest. I'm never leaving this show.
Great. We have a third host, ladies and gentlemen.
So should we go into Peter Pan?
Let's do it.
Yes.
Okay, so with Peter Pan, there's so many amazing elements that she incorporates in Peter Pan. And one of it is like the mood and the lighting and the subtle glows that she adds to a lot of her artwork, especially anytime Peter Pan's like holding Tinkerbell or Tinkerbell's in a scene. It's just this very soft little glow around her. And it's just so whimsical and pretty. Even with the scene, this is like my favorite Mary Blair painting probably ever. And it's the ship leaving Neverland, and it's all gold, and it's that soft lighting behind it, and it's just so dreamy. I just you can just like live inside of one of her Peter Pan paintings.
I would love to.
Yeah.
One thing I've always noticed about it that I've always loved is a lot of times like the sky color she would use would be a very pale green or a soft teal, or it was something that was just enough to show you that Neverland is different than real life.
Yeah. Yeah,
it's its own world. It's its own place. And I love the layering that she does in her paintings. When you look at the Mermaid Lagoon scene, there's so many layers. It almost looks like it could be a paper sculpture. Mm-hmm. It's just like on top of each other, there's rock work and then there's beautiful plants and foliage. And, you know, far in the distance, you'll see the mermaids, and it gives that sense of they're enclosed. And it's just such a beautiful scene. It just makes them look even more ethereal, I think, when you can add those types of layers and depth and lighting.
Yeah, her lighting is magical. It's just
it is. It's
magical.
It's so magical. And I love the layering of all of her plants and foliage. There's a Follow the Leader painting that she does, and it's just like all these like beautiful plants, and there're greens and there's purples and there's blues, and it's just so soft. But at the same time, it's just so dynamic, and it gives that feeling of adventure and excitement and something big is about to happen. And I feel like she can take any idea for a scene. You can give her any emotion and she's going to be able to convey it with just her color and lighting. Mm-hmm. It's so magical. And honestly, it's one of the reasons why I went and I took color theory classes when I was in college because of that, because I wanted to know how color can affect someone's mood and how people interpret color and how can I make a scene feel the way I want it to feel and give that audience that feeling to make it a little more personal and a little more deep and emotional for them.
Mm-hmm. I love that. I would love to see some maybe concept art from Ashley Taylor in future Disney movies. You never know. I'm like, hearing you talk about this, I was like, you need to be doing this too someday.
Oh my gosh, you are so sweet. I would attribute Mary Blair to this, but I probably spend more time just figuring out what colors I'm going to use before I figure out what I'm actually going to draw for the composition. I think of the emotion first.
I love that.
Yeah, you can see that in your work. You can see how important color is in your work. Even in your doodles, the colors are so distinct. And you can really see that you pay attention to that.
Oh, thank you.
Anyway. Well, More gushing.
Don't mind us.
I love the sense of difference in her painting just between Neverland and between like old London town. You can definitely tell like she's making it two very distinct places and she wants you to feel a certain way about each one of them. There's one scene that she painted and it's of Neverland and it has this like beautiful glow around it and it's purples and it's greens and it's blues. It's almost like the Northern Lights that is like surrounding Neverland to make it look so ethereal and beautiful. And it just makes it look welcoming and mysterious, but it's also so dynamic with the color choices that she uses. So it's like every feeling you want to have when you see Neverland for the first time, she just delivers it.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
I love it so much. I could just talk about her color.
Don't mind me after we record this. I'm just going to be Googling Mary Blair artwork.
Yeah, no, we're going to be looking at artwork all evening.
I have like all of her artwork and different art books just like laid out in front of me. I just like look at it. I'm like, man, like the amount of emotion she can accomplish and all the effort that she puts into, but then she can make it look so relatable and she can translate those feelings so easily that, you know, a little kid can understand it or a grown adult can understand it. And that's just a very special trait to have.
And that's what makes her so perfect for It's a Small World, because obviously that's supposed to speak to everyone around the world, regardless of language or age.
So true. I almost feel like Peter Pan leads into It's a Small World because of the layering and the geometric shapes when you see like the building of the leaves. I feel like that always translates to me and like, okay, that's the jump you take.
Yeah.
Should I segue to It's a Small World?
Yeah, that was a great segue, Jess.
Didn't even plan it. Mic drop. So during the time between Peter Pan and It's a Small World, Mary Blair actually resigned from Disney to be a freelance graphic designer and illustrator. She did a lot of work creating advertisements for major companies, as well as illustrating several little golden books during this time. And many of the golden books were Disney little golden books, which is why, you know, little golden books, I feel, is kind of known for having that similar Mary Blair style. That's a big reason why. So even though she wasn't working for Disney, her work during that time with Disney is still really important because obviously those Disney little golden books are iconic. So Walt wanted Mary to come back to join the team at WED Enterprises, you know, aka Walt Disney Imagineering. He wanted her to join the team at WED Enterprises to help with the design of It's a Small World 11 years later after Peter Pan. So let's dive a little bit first into how It's a Small World came about. It was pretty interesting. And I'm really curious if you guys knew this stuff about how it came about. So It's a Small World was, of course, one of the four attractions at the 1964 World's Fair, which the 1964 World's Fair definitely warrants its own episode sometime. But for the purposes of this episode, we're just going to focus on It's a Small World. I'm going to take a leap here and say It's a Small World is the most famous of the four 1964 attractions. Like, obviously, Carousel of Progress is very famous too, but I feel like globally, It's a Small World is probably the most famous of the
appropriately.
But it was actually the last attraction to come about, and it had 1 month to be made. So, you know, it was on a time crunch. It was fast. It was a time crunch, only had 1 month to be made. So Pepsi Cola and the United Nations Children's Fund, aka UNICEF, were looking to co-sponsor an exhibit together, but Pepsi had been dragging their feet on making a decision on what their pavilion would be. They had no idea what they were going to do. And a board member for Pepsi Cola at the time was none other than actress Joan Crawford. And Crawford was the one who suggested they reach out to Walt Disney to have WED work on an attraction for this pavilion. And Pepsi didn't really want to do it, but she was basically like, everything Walt touches turns to gold. Like, trust me, we should approach Walt Disney about doing this. And so they did it, you know, partly because they only had 1 month and they didn't have a lot of time. So Walt Disney pulled together the designers at WED Enterprises and said he had an idea for a little boat ride. So ideas were drawn up for It's a Small World, and they were shown to the board members at Pepsi-Cola, and they were not impressed with the concepts. But Joan Crawford came to the rescue again and pushed the board to approve Walt's idea for It's a Small World. Yay, Joan! For Small World, when Pepsi-Cola was on the brink on passing on Walt's ideas. The irony that Mommy Dearest encouraged a ride to benefit UNICEF. It was just fun, ironic.
So much.
So where did Mary Blair come in? Walt felt that her art style was perfect for this. Imagineer Raleigh Crump said Walt saw a rendering of children from around the world on a carousel that was done by, Imagineer Disney legend Mark Davis. And Raleigh said Walt took one look at it and said, "What's Mary Blair doing?" When he saw he saw this concept art Mark Davis came up with, and he was like, "Mary Blair needs to be working on this." She, of course, said she would love to do it. Raleigh Crump said, this is a quote, "I think it hit her at the right time, since it was about children, the freedom of color, and that Walt asked her to do it." I wanted to share really quick an excerpt from Don Hahn's book, Yesterday's Tomorrow. I just thought this excerpt was really fun to see how people at Disney worked together to make this all happen. Like, it was really a collaborative effort. So this is a beginning of quote. "The audio animatronic children who would need to be individually costumed, then placed into stylized settings of their homelands. The overall design fell to Mary Blair, whose sense of simplicity and love of folk art influenced the look of the ride. Other wed stalwarts like Mark Davis would contribute two ideas for each setting. The costuming fell to Mark's wife, Alice Davis, who plundered the Los Angeles Fashion District for fabrics, buttons, feathers, bangles, and beads. Crump designed the Tower of the Four Winds in front of the building, and Teehee, once a venerable story man at Disney, was called back to work on the toys and figures of the attractions." And then, of course, Raleigh later would design the front facade of It's a Small World when they moved it from the World's Fair to Disneyland, but that still was very much influenced by Mary Blair, who kind of set the overall design of the ride. But I just wanted to read that quick little excerpt. I just thought it was fun to think of the hustle and bustle energy and the creative masterminds working together in this specific point in time at Disney. I just thought that was really cool. And the fact that they did it in 1 month's time, I thought that was really awesome.
And what was that called? It was like bangles and bows.
Bangles and
bows. I just
bows.
See all these them in a flurry tiny costumes.
Doing this research, I didn't include it in here, but I was like, well, I'll throw it in now that you brought it up. But Raleigh Crump had said on the Walt Disney Family Museum podcast that him and Mary, they felt there weren't enough flitter and feathers and jewels on the set and the toys meaning like if there's a little paper mache animal or something like that. So basically the characters in the ride that aren't animatronic children. And he said, we looked at the ride and before Walt came to see it, we thought we need to fix this. There's not enough flitter or feather or jewels. So they went to the Los Angeles Fashion District and bought every flitter, feather and jewel they could get their hands on. And Raleigh said that the accounting department had a fit with them because they said, "You spent $200 on flitter." And he said, "It's what needs to be done."
It was worth it. They needed more flitter.
They needed more flitter. You spent $200 on flitter. It's what needed to be done. That was what he said on the podcast. It's what needed
to be done.
I'm going to
start saying that at all of my design meetings.
Yeah. It's what needed to be done.
Yeah.
You just leave it at there.
You should, Ashley. You deserve it.
And so I just thought, I wanted to give that backstory because I just thought it's so wild to think this ride wouldn't have existed without Joan Crawford and Mary Blair developed the design for the ride. Like, what visionary queens? Like,
I had no idea Joan Crawford was in any way involved in this story.
I didn't either. I was like, this is so random. I love it. Yeah, so I just thought that was very, very interesting. So It's a Small World, many feel, is Mary Blair's most notable work. You know, I think it's because it is very much befitting for her style and the themes that she incorporated in her work. And I read an Oh My Disney article that put it very well why her art style fit just so perfectly in creating the concept for It's a Small World. Her graphic style would be perfect for the complex show scenes, and her attention to detail and ability to turn a complex culture into one that is easily relatable through a modern visual shorthand was imperative for this attraction's success. and the colors in It's a Small World, which would turn out to be a wildly important achievement, remains one of the purest distillations of Blair's work. Not just her design aesthetic, although that is also at the forefront, but her emotional temperature, her unique sensibilities, and her outlook on the world. Mm-hmm. But I thought that put it really perfectly why she was just the right fit for this. Mary Blair would do renderings in her unique style of the different places around the world, and then her drawings were taken into the Wed model shop to then turn her drawings into model sets for Walt to look at and approve, and then the models would get turned into a full-size set for the attraction at the World's Fair. And Raleigh Crump and Mary Blair, near the opening of the attraction, were over on the soundstage at the 1964 World's Fair full time, overseeing everything was put in place just right before Walt would see it. What a dream team, right?
Oh, I know.
Yeah. Yes. So that's kind of the background for It's a Small World. And after It's a Small World, Mary Blair began diving into a new medium of art that worked really well with her uniquely hued collage style artwork, ceramics. Ceramics became a more enticing way for her to do her mural artwork. She had done a few murals that were watercolor based or other paints, but she was beginning to feel that ceramics were a more enticing way for her to do mural work since the colors were so vibrant. And the thing is, when she would paint murals, the colors would fade over time, but in ceramics, it stayed the same vibrancy that she intended. So it became a very enticing art medium for her. So Mary Blair, over the years, had been commissioned to do many murals. There's a It's a Small World inspired mural at the Jules Stein Eye Clinic at UCLA. And in 1967, she had two murals for the entrance of the new Tomorrowland at Disneyland when it was unveiled. Walt commissioned her to do this, of course, before he passed away in 1966, but they were finally finished in 1967. And they were very similar to the UCLA mural that depicted children from around the world. And similar to It's a Small World vibes, too. So how are these ceramic murals done? Well, she would draw her art like a normal sized painting. She would create her paintings. Then her paintings would be projected on the wall where the ceramic mural would be put into place. And then they would have someone who, you know, was a ceramics expert look at the projection on the wall and grid out how many tiles and how many of each color and what size they needed to be. So then they would get the ceramics made. I know at least the contemporary resort ceramics were manufactured in Glendale. I'm assuming maybe these were manufactured in the same place. I would need to check. But so they would project her painting. They would have a ceramics expert grid it out, and then they would have them made and installed. Now, these murals in Tomorrowland were pretty significant because you have to think, when you go on an attraction built by Wed artists, you're not seeing the names of the Imagineers on the work done. Like, you're not seeing Bob Gurr's signature on the Matterhorn bobsled.
Yeah.
So you're not seeing their signatures. It was an actual thing that was said that individual artists weren't credited because the artistry within the park was supposed to feel more cinematic, like, or, you know, being immersed into a world. They don't want to take you out of that. And also, you know, it was considered everything was done as a team. People mm-hmm. weren't like, this is my thing. This is your thing.
And it's a story too.
Yeah.
You're experiencing a story. You're not thinking about maybe the individual artist. You're trying to get into the mindset of you're inside the
story.
And
feeling like you're being transported into like this fictional world.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So when she was commissioned by Walt to do the two Tomorrowland murals, one was by Circle Vision 360, which is now Buzz Lightyear Astro Blasters, depicted children from around the world that represented global communications. And the other one was over Adventure Through Inner Space, which is now Star Tours, that also had children from around the world, but focused on solar power, wind energy, and water power. And she was given credit, which was the first time an individual artist had their name on something at the parks. Her name was on the murals. So obviously these murals, we don't see them today, but are they gone?
Where are they?
They're still there.
What?
Where are they?
Where
did
are
they cover us?
Okay, so these are two 54-foot long murals, and at least half of it is there, if not more than half. So you know that wall that stretches between Star Tours entrance and Star Traders? There's like a long stretch of wall that sometimes if the line for Star Tours is really long, they'll like have you start lining up there. And yeah, so in that area, that's where one of her murals was. And so it was thought that that one was intact, but there is a home video from 1986 that someone uploaded to YouTube, and it shows a construction worker literally like chipping the tiles away, which is it was painful to watch.
That is so
horrible. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Why didn't they keep him?
It was a home video from that someone took who was visiting Disneyland. They uploaded it from 1986. So someone chipping it away. But it was just kind of near the bottom. But Marty Sklar says it's still there. And he was, you know, head of Imagineering and all that. So I feel like he'd have a pretty good idea. But we've at least know that some of that one is gone. Maybe it's not that much, but we know from that home video, some of it is gone. But on the other side where Buzz Lightyear Astro Blasters is, now that mural was over the area where the Buzz Lightyear Astro Blasters Fast Pass distribution and Little Green Men store command is. Mm. So it stretched across that area. Now that one is just covered up and encased. It's just there.
Wow. That makes me sad.
So the first mural, as I mentioned, was covered in 1986 for anticipation of Star Tours opening. And then the second one remained in place, the one on the Buzz Lightyear side. That one remained for 11 additional years. So for a while, this mural that they put for Star Tours and then Mary Blair's mural over Circle Vision, they were just facing one another and they were completely different styles. Yeah. And they were just facing one another.
I get why they covered them up for theming, but it's still heartbreaking.
Well,
like, I know.
I'll take it. I'll take the mural.
I mean, yeah, and I'm going to get into theories as to why it's still there and other theories on the internet. So as I mentioned, it's unclear how much of the Star Tours side of the mural remains, if any, but the Buzz one apparently is still there. And so I do wonder that nowadays, if this decision were being made, like say these murals had been displayed this whole time, if they were going to cover it up to build a new attraction, I wonder, would they try... I really don't know. Would they try to remove them? Because obviously they must be worth millions of dollars. It's not like Disney would sell them, but, you know, put them in the archives. Like, it is a work of art by one of the most famous female artists in modern times. Would they take it down? Or since it's ceramics in cement, I don't really know if you could take it down. So maybe they would just try to entomb it, as the theory goes that they are right now. So I do wonder if this decision were being made today, I guess they did the best option they could. Because I don't really know how you could take a ceramic mural apart that's affixed to a cement structure. I don't know how all that works.
Well, but, you know that if it happened today, people would be angrily tweeting about how they shouldn't take them down because nobody likes any change.
I'm not going to lie, guys. It is a hard pill to swallow that there's the sign for Little Green Store Command and a Star Tours painting covering a Mary Blair ceramic mural. That's a hard pill.
It is.
Like, oh gosh, I don't like to think about it. But so according to Imagineer Marty Sklar, the murals are completely undamaged and intact. You know, as I said, there's some chipping that we saw in that video. So how intact? But according to him, they're intact. And he said Mary Blair's murals were not damaged or painted over, but the decision was made for cost reasons to leave them in place. Hidden treasures at Disneyland. So he said that they're just entombed. And it does make me wonder, you know, every D23 fans always think that Disney's going to announce that they're going to change Tomorrowland because it gets outdated quickly. And, you know, I think fans would love to see a mid-century modern looking Tomorrowland because, you know.
Yeah, I think that'd be really beautiful.
That's a great fit right now. You know, that's very in and it's timeless. And I think it's cool to do the retro space age rather than keep trying to make it look futuristic because obviously that gets outdated quickly.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
It does make me wonder, like, how intact is it if they took down Little Green Store Command sign and Star Tours mural? Like, could we potentially see a mid-century modern-looking Tomorrowland and they could re-unveil the Mary Blair ceramics? I don't know, but it's a fun thought to think about.
That would be cool.
Yeah.
Like, can you imagine? It's also just wild to think, like, you're basically walking past these works of art and people have no idea. I had no idea that they were still there until I was like doing all this research. And
I
so it's,
either.
Yeah, I had no idea.
To think about, well, they're still there. And I like the thought that they are still there because maybe we will see them someday. So later on, she was commissioned to create what is called the Grand Canyon Concourse mural in the Contemporary Resort. So, you know, the hotel at Walt Disney World Resort that the monorail goes through. So that huge mural in the Contemporary Resort, that was done by Mary Blair. Now, this mural is 90 feet tall. And the mural, of course, from its name, was inspired by the Grand Canyon. And she said each part of the mural was inspired by research she had done of Native American cultures and the American Southwest. So many parts of the mural was inspired by Native American basket weaving, which she felt was a natural fit for this mural because it kind of feels like a tapestry being hung in the hotel. And she wanted it to look like a tapestry. So when you do look at the mural, it does look like it's embroidered or weaved. And she said that was inspired by Native American basket weaving. Imagineers had wanted a very colorful mural in this hotel since the colors of the hotel are, you know, mainly white, a little bit of black, so very muted. So they wanted the hotel to have a fresh modern feel by being that sleek black and white with just this big pop of color that's the centerpiece that your eyes are drawn to when you enter the hotel. So they had commissioned her to do this mural to be the standout feature, which of course it is. And it had a budget of $10 million. Wow. And it was made up of 18,000 square tiles, and it took 2 months to install. And as I mentioned earlier, of course, Mary Blair isn't installing these tiles herself. She drew the art. She created a 19-inch painting. So it's only 19 inches. Mm. She did a 19-inch painting, which ceramic experts, it was I believe it was UCLA or USC student, but she was a ceramics expert, and they commissioned her to be on this project to be the one to grid out how many ceramic tiles are needed, what proportions do you need each ceramic tile, and all that. And her name is actually displayed underneath Mary Blair's, so she got credit for this as well, which I thought was cool. So I don't know if you guys knew this, but I think it is definitely like a Walt Disney World pass holder thing, where it's like a hidden thing that Walt Disney World pass holders know about. But there's a five-legged goat on the mural that's kind of famous among fans. So Disney was looking to replace the mural at one point because of the five-legged goat, and they thought it was a mistake when they were getting the ceramic tiles manufactured, but it would cost obviously way too much money, so the five-legged goat stayed. But the common theory, and also what's funny, in the Walt Disney World opening video, they unveiled the mural to Mary Blair for her to see, and they filmed her reaction, and she just like looked up and went, "Oh, wow." And she had like interviews. People interviewed her later being like, "Why did you have that reaction?" It was like one of those reactions that you do when you're like,
great.
Great. But I mean, that's the theory of like, she seemed kind of taken aback. She never confirmed she was taken aback. But so there had been interviews about like, why did you have that reaction? She was just like, I was just in awe. So, but some people theorize she had that reaction because of the five-legged goat mistake. Also in the book, The Art and Flair of Mary Blair, it is said that the common theory is that this was intentional. And, you know, as I mentioned, she researched Native American cultures when she did this piece. And it is a Navajo tradition to incorporate flaws into crafts and artwork to differentiate humans from the perfection of the divine. So it is said she did it on purpose.
That's what I've always heard about it.
But it hasn't been confirmed. So there's lots of theories of like, did she do it on purpose for that reason, or was it an accident? And that's the theory of that's what it is. So nobody knows for sure what it is, which I think is kind of funny. Like, we don't know if it was intentional or a mistake, but in any case, the five-legged goat is iconic.
That's a cool theory. I like that theory.
Yeah. And you know, to sum her later work up with Disney, I mean, obviously she helped create so many timeless films, as you guys talked about. So when it comes to film, she's definitely made her mark. And, you know, same with the theme parks. There's a little Mary Blair that Raleigh Crump designed. She's a character in It's a Small World up on top of the Eiffel Tower in the France scene. She's the blonde holding a balloon. So she's in the attraction. And also, you know, It's a Small World is at pretty much every Disney resort around the world, for the exception of Shanghai. So it is a classic.
I didn't know that she was, that a character of her was actually in the ride. That's really cute.
Yeah. So cute. There's a cute photo of Raleigh showing the characters, Raleigh, Crump, and Walt Disney are standing next to each other, and Raleigh's holding the Mary Blair character for the ride and showing it to her.
That's really cool.
Yeah, so he's sweet. And he said, I went to the Fashion District and I got these, he said this on the Walt Disney Family Museum podcast episode about the World's Fair, and he said, I got these like yellow chicken feathers. Obviously they weren't real chicken feathers, but he's like, I got these yellow chicken feathers for her hair.
That's really cute.
Yeah.
So sweet.
Yeah, so that is her legacy with the parks.
Yeah.
Yay!
We love Small World. Like, that's a favorite among our families. Like, we love them as adults, and our kids love Small World. Clara always wants to go on it. Amelia too, right, Jessica?
Amelia loves to go on it. We are in this Small World scene, my family and I, in the Decorating Disney Holiday Magic special. And she often wants to watch that special, but just the Small World part, because, I mean, she wants to see herself, you know.
That's understandable.
That's understandable. So but yeah, so it's special, too, for that reason, in addition to, obviously, just being timeless. Yeah. And yeah.
Yeah.
So anyway, Mary Blair is a legend, period. Well, thank you so much, Ashley, for coming on to talk to us about the wonderful Mary Blair, as well as your own artwork and the inspiration behind some of your amazing Disney pieces. We had such a great time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yes.
Yeah, thank you.
Could you let our listeners know where they could find you on social media if they want to follow along with your artwork?
Yeah, you can follow me at Ashley24Taylor on Instagram or Twitter, but I'm on Instagram way more often.
Yeah.
And you could find me at The Healthy Mouse on Instagram, or just Healthy_Mouse on Twitter.
And I am at Keep Quirky on Instagram and Keep Quirky OC on Twitter. And if you want to find Cartoons to Castles, you can find us at Cartoons to Castles on Instagram, Cartoons Castles on Twitter. And if you want to share the podcast with friends, they can find out where to listen at cartoonstocastles.com.
Yeah, and if you have anything that you want to say to us, or any other fun little tidbits about any topics we talked about, or just let us know about a topic you maybe want to hear about, you guessed it, you can email us at cartoonstocastles@gmail.com.
You guessed it.
Yeah. Bye.
Thanks for listening.
Till next time. Keep dreaming.